Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero, and then eventually to Hemingway professionals, Hemingway legends, in 1 year flat, except not. I've got to work on a new slogan, clearly. The Hemingway List subreddit is coming along nicely. A little place to call our own. Not that the A Year of War and Peace subreddit wasn't an awesome home to belong to, and I still feel like I'm very much always going to be part of that community. But to have our own little slice of the internet, reddit.com/r/TheHemingwayList, all sort of just dedicated to the podcast and to the community around the podcast. What a cool thing that is. We're up to 28 subscribers on the subreddit, which is cool. The podcast itself has something like 1,300 subscribers, which I'm pretty chuffed with. But the subreddit, I don't know, there's just something so exciting about that, because it might only be 28 people. It might not sound like a lot, but it's very much a community. You know, there's a group of people that want to discuss literature, want to get involved. I'm trying to set the trend. I put a little meme on there yesterday, which was that Futurama face, the Fry one, where he's kind of squinting, and it says, "Not sure if perfect illustration of the mundanity of life or just a boring ending." Not the wittiest thing ever, but I just thought it was funny. Anyway, I would love to set a precedent here of putting funny memes on the Hemingway List subreddit, because, you know, memes are funny. So I encourage those 28 subscribers and everyone listening to go ahead and make some funny comments, funny memes, pictures. I love this podcast called Your Mom's House Podcast. It's Tom Segura and Christina Pasinski. The thing I love about it is that they've got this tradition, I suppose, now of their fans or their listeners constantly sending in material. They send in songs that they've made, like theme songs for the podcast. They send in memes. They send in funny videos. They send all kinds of funny stuff. And I love that. I love that a good, probably like 50% of the show is the listeners of the show sending in things. And they always put them up on the podcast. Like, they speak about them or they play the songs or whatever. Anyway, my point is, I dream that I could create a community even partway as engaged as that. Because, I don't know, the thing I love about that podcast is it feels like it's everyone's. It's not just the host, it's everyone. And that's part of what I love about A Year of War and Peace, is that so much of the content, the comments that I'm reading, isn't just me speaking, it's everyone. So I really want that to happen with the Hemingway List, and I want to go further with it. You know, so if you feel like getting out your guitar and writing a silly War and Peace song, please do. If you want to make a meme, please do. It's all very much encouraged. Anyway, we're up to the epilogue. We're starting the epilogue. So today we are reading First Epilogue, Chapter 1, and it goes like this. 7 years had passed. Oh, wow. Straight off the bat, I'm just going to say 7 years passing. Just like that. All of a sudden, I'm excited to see what our characters are up to 7 years later. There's also a big bloody march fly, or probably just like a blowfly, flying around this room, which you probably just heard it a moment ago. I'll have to get rid of that before I continue, or it will drive me insane and probably will drive you, the listeners, insane too, to hear that. So bear with me for a minute while I deal with that.
Damn it, a fly. It's disappeared. Must have heard me.
Must have heard what I was saying, because now it's gone. You know what's going to happen. I'll start reading and the damn thing will come back. Alright. 7 years had passed. The storm-tossed sea of European history had subsided within its shores and seemed to have become calm. But the mysterious forces that move humanity, mysterious because the laws of their motion are unknown to us, continued to operate. Though the surface of the sea of history seemed motionless, the movement of humanity went on unceasingly as the flow of time. Various groups of people formed and dissolved, the coming formation and dissolution of kingdoms and displacement of peoples was in course of preparation. The sea of history was not driven spasmodically from shore to shore as previously. It was seething in its depths. Historic figures were not borne by the waves from one shore to another as before. They now seemed to rotate on the spot. The historical figures at the head of armies, who formerly reflected the movement of the masses by ordering wars, campaigns, and battles, now reflected the restless movement of political and diplomatic combinations, laws, and treaties. The historians call this activity of the historical figures the reaction. In dealing with this period, they sternly condemn the historical personages who, in their opinion, caused what they describe as the reaction. All the well-known people of that period, from Alexander and Napoleon to Madame de Stael, Photius, Schelling, Fichte, Chateaubriand, and the rest, pass before their stern judgment seat and are acquitted or condemned according to whether they conduct to progress or to reaction. Oh, I've just had another go at the fly. I sprayed it with some bug spray, and now it's gone berserk. Okay, it's in the next room though, so hopefully you can't hear it. Photius, Schelling, Fichte, Chateaubriand, and the rest pass before their stern judgment seat, and are acquitted or condemned according to whether they conduced to progress or to reaction. According to their accounts, a reaction took place at that time in Russia also, and the chief culprit was Alexander I, the same man who, according to them, was the chief cause of the liberal movement at the commencement of his reign, as well as of saving Russia. There is no one in Russian literature now, from schoolboy essayist to learned historian, who does not throw his little stone at Alexander for things he did wrong at this period of his reign. He ought to have acted in this way and in that way. In this case he did well, and in that case badly. He behaved admirably at the beginning of his reign and during 1812, but acted badly by giving a constitution to Poland, forming the Holy Alliance, entrusting power to Arakchiv, favouring Golitsyn and mysticism, and afterwards Shishkov and Photius. He also acted badly by concerning himself with the active army and disbanding the Semenov regiment. It would take a dozen pages to enumerate all the reproaches the historians address to him based on their knowledge of what is good for humanity. What do these reproaches mean? Do not the very actions for which the historians praise Alexander I, the liberal attempts at the beginning of his reign, his struggle with Napoleon, the firmness he displayed in 1812, and the campaign of 1813, flow from the same sources, the circumstances of his birth, education, and life that made his personality what it was, and from which the actions for which they blame him, the Holy Alliance, the restoration of Poland, and the reaction of 1820 and later, also flowed. In what does the substance of those reproaches lie? It lies in the fact that a historical character like Alexander I, standing on the highest possible pinnacle of human power, with the blinding light of history focused upon him, a character exposed to those strongest of all influences, the intrigues, flattery, and self-deception inseparable from power, a character who at every moment of his life felt responsibility for all that was happening in Europe, and not a fictitious but a live character who, like every man, had his personal habits, passions, and impulses towards goodness, beauty, and truth, that this character, though not lacking in virtue, the historians do not accuse him of that, had not the same conception of the welfare of humanity 50 years ago, as a present-day professor, who, from his youth upwards, has been occupied with learning, that is, with books and lectures, and with taking notes from them. The footnote here reminds us that War and Peace was completed in 1869, so 50 years ago, in that previous sentence, is referring to the time frame of the novel. But even if we assume that 50 years ago Alexander I was mistaken in his view of what was good for the people, we must inevitably assume that the historian who judges Alexander will also, after some lapse of time, turn out to be mistaken in his view of what is good for humanity. This assumption is all the more natural and inevitable because, watching the movement of history, we see that every year, and with each new writer, opinion as to what is good for mankind changes, so that we once seemed good, 10 years later, seems bad, and vice versa. And what is more, we find at one and the same time quite contradictory views as to what is bad and what is good in history. Some people regard giving a constitution to Poland and forming the Holy Alliance as praiseworthy in Alexander, while others regard it as blameworthy. The activity of Alexander or of Napoleon cannot be called useful or harmful, for it is impossible to say for what it was useful or harmful. If that activity displeases somebody, this is only because it does not agree with his limited understanding of what is good. Whether the preservation of my father's house in Moscow, or the glory of the Russian arms, or the prosperity of the Petersburg and other universities, or the freedom of Poland, or the greatness of Russia, or the balance of power in Europe, or a certain kind of European culture called progress, appear to me to be good or bad, I must admit that besides these things, the action of every historic character has other more general purposes inaccessible to me. But let us assume that what is called science can harmonize all contradictions and possesses an unchanging standard of good and bad by which to try historic characters and events. Let us say that Alexander could have done everything differently. Let us say that by guidance from those who blame him and who profess to know the ultimate aim of the movement of humanity, he might have arranged matters according to the program his present accusers would have given him, of nationality, freedom, equality, and progress. These, I think, cover the ground. Let us assume that this program was possible, and had then been formulated, and that Alexander had acted on it. What would then have become of the activity of all those who opposed the tendency that then prevailed in the government? The activity that, in the opinion of the historians, was good and beneficent. Their activity would not have existed. There would have been no life. There would have been nothing. If we admit that human life can be ruled by reason, the possibility of life is destroyed. Wow, what a line to end on. If we admit that human life can be ruled by reason, the possibility of life is destroyed. Whew. All right, there we go, another chapter down. Just quickly going to go through some advertising. This podcast is brought to you by Audible. If you would like a free Audible trial, a 1 month Audible subscription, you can visit audibletrial.com/ander. audibletrial.com/ander. Audible has a massive range of audiobooks that you can choose from, and with your trial, you actually get a free audiobook. So you could get a audiobook of some more Tolstoy or some more Russian classics. You could go with something modern. There are new release audiobooks on there. I recommended Stephen King's It as an audiobook. Could be really cool. It's a great book. I actually haven't listened to it as an audiobook, but I have read it, and it is brilliant. So, if you want to start listening to audiobooks, audibletrial.com/ander. Thank you very much for your patience there. Now, here's something quite telling. We've moved from the novel to the epilogue. That's a big move. It's the start of the end, the beginning of the end, and there is literally not a single comment on the discussion forum for this chapter, quite tellingly, because, what was it? Wasn't much to it. It was exactly the type of chapter that people have been complaining about all throughout the novel. One of Tolstoy's historian rants about political things and how wrong historians are. Turtle Vader said, Tolstoy advocates against any historian or moralist that would define the actions of Alexander as either good or bad. Why do you think he feels this way? Advocates against any historian or moralist who would define the actions of Alexander as either good or bad. I suppose he's advocating for the complexity of his situation. That, black and good and bad might be too black and white for this situation, given the complexities. You can't sum Alexander up as all good. You can't sum him up as terrible. And likewise, you look at his individual actions during this time period, and they've got their pros and cons. Turtle Vader also said, looking back at the historical events of the French invasion of Russia, do you think any one ruler was in the right or wrong at any given point? Very interesting question. I suppose I still don't really know all that much, I've learned a hell of a lot through this book, but I still don't really know. When we look at the motivations for the war, what were they? I suppose France was just trying to expand an empire, and that was really it. There was no religious motivation, was there? Or was there? I don't think so. And there was no real economic one either that springs to mind. Maybe I'm wrong on both of those fronts. Russia was a big fan of French society. French society at this time was sort of the epitome, the utmost in culture, right? It was something to envy. So it was kind of a strange thing. Russia are being invaded. France have declared themselves the enemy. But I don't know, it was kind of like as brutal as the war was and as many deaths and some pretty gritty stuff. There was this weird civilness to it, wasn't there? Lastly, Turtle Vader says, if life cannot be governed by reason, what should govern it? Such a good question as well. Turtle Vader on fire with these questions. Very polarizing question, this one, to answer. But when you look at reason, what's the opposite of reason, really? That's not the answer, but the counter-argument, I suppose, to reason is it's often maybe like spiritual or religious is given as the counter-argument. God, how do I answer this? It's such a tricky question to approach, you know. We know that Tolstoy, in this novel, referred to the Germans as sort of being too logical, too, like, attached to logic, reason, and rationality. And it was almost like, if you go too far down that road, you lose something else, which is like the human spirit, maybe you could sum it up as. You can look at everything through a scientific lens, reasonable, rationally, but at a certain point you lose the human spirit in doing that, because the human spirit wasn't cooked up in a science lab. It spewed out of our DNA, right? And it's not always logical or reasonable or rational. So when you look at humans, or you be a human, or you try to figure out the nature of humanity, then often reason and logic and rationality, it's not the be all and end all of the equation, if that makes sense. So I think that's what Tolstoy is saying here, that if you govern just using statistics and numbers and equations, boil everything down to an algorithm, then I suppose, what was the line? The possibility of life is annihilated. There's something that I learned about the Russians reading this novel, is that they tend to walk that line really well. They're not entirely irrational. They're not completely adverse to reason and statistics and science. But at the same time, they do value just humanness. Just do the thing that seems the most human. Could also be a solution. And I suppose there's a balance on that scale in every person and in every group of people and in every nation, and however you want to slice it. Tolstoy certainly depicted the Germans as being too far into the rational side. And I wonder where the other side would live, the spirit. Maybe the French, maybe that's the counterpoint to that. We know that they are very passionate, they are very poetic, they do embrace the aesthetic, not just the innovations, but also just things for the sake of beauty. And Russia, maybe they're somewhere in between. Is all that what Tolstoy was trying to say? I actually don't know, but let's go with that. Now, DBird6464, welcome to the podcast, DBird6464, responded to a question that I was asking in yesterday's episode, throwing back to Pierre, who, by the way, after reading today's chapter, I don't know if we're ever going to hear about Pierre again. I've just got this feeling that the rest of this book is going to be these political diatribes. Anyway, DBird6464 answered the question, why did Pierre have to go back to Petersburg? I couldn't remember for the life of me. Pierre couldn't even remember himself. DBird said, wasn't Pierre going to clear up his wife's debts? I think she was there when Napoleon showed up. He probably had property there too. Definitely that was it. He was going there to fix up his wife's debts and to, I think, to restore a property or something like that. It was something like he had to rebuild something, and he'd done the maths, and if he didn't rebuild it, he'd be far wealthier, but he's decided to rebuild it and give up 2/3 of his wealth or something like that. It's all coming back to me now. But yeah, certainly it was to clean up his wife's affairs, financial affairs. Thank you, D-Bird, for that. All right, on that note, that's going to do it for today. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.